we might as well get started. So, I'm Robin Cooper, and I emailed you, if you haven't already got your email, about, you know, what's going on today. Bruce O'Hare is gone for a meeting, and so he asked me to fill in. And so I already had put up your PowerPoints. I recognize some of you from 350 City, Animal Physiology, sitting in the same places, so this is interesting. This is the Intro to Neuroscience course, and it's really exciting that you're in this course. It only started a few years back, so it's a neat course, and we hope that you all are interested in neuroscience, or physiology in general, too, carrying on. Just out of curiosity, how many of you are doing research right now in labs? A few people. Are they neuroscience labs? Yes? All right, good. So actually, that's a good thing to rapport with each other and find out how your labs are working out and then communicate with other students. How many of you have heard of Tri Beta? Biology Honor Society? Okay. So that's a good group to belong to as well. You have some members that are in here. And that's another way to share notes with each other, basically, about labs to work in and other opportunities that you have. So the Tri Beta, we actually have a bulletin board on the outside down the hallway there. You can look at it behind that glass cabinet, and you can contact your officers there and get involved if you like. All right, so you've already had some aspects in the neuroscience, and so Bruce O'Hara gave me his PowerPoints to use, so I'm basically going to cover some of his PowerPoints and then add a few things to it as well to add some other views to it. But basically we're talking about the autonomic nervous system and how to explain the autonomic nervous system and what is it about. So it's what do you think about the autonomic nervous system? What do you think when you hear the autonomic nervous system? Any ideas? Just off the top of your head. Autonomic, what does that mean? Auto, kind of automatic. You don't have to think about it. Like you're not having to think. You see all those crazy YouTube videos where the person has the headsets on, says breathe in, breathe out, right? You don't have to think about breathing, right? You're just autonomically working. If you get scared, you're not having to think about it. It's like a response that just happens autonomically, right? So that's more or less your autonomic nervous system. And so we're going to focus on that. And there's a couple divisions of that we're going to talk about. So what do we mean by this? It's basically this fight or flight, right, for the sympathetic nervous system. Oh, well, I don't know if I introduced myself. So I'm Robin Cooper. I've been here at UK for about 18 years. Feels like forever, but it does go. It's been fun. And so if you have any questions, glad to answer any questions you have. I'm recording this on Echo 360, and I post it on my website. So that was the email that I sent you. It's also on a podcast, so it'll go up on a podcast. Your PowerPoints are already up on that website, and a PDF version is already up on that website. So you can download that and get access to it. All right. So the autonomic nervous system, we generally think of fight or flight, right, for the sympathetic, are parasympathetic, rest and digest. There's been some interest in this aspects of actually having a third division, and we'll talk about that as well. It's not too much talked about in your textbook or in textbooks commonly in the West, but in the East we talk about another division, some like in the Russian area or Eastern Europe, and even in Europe itself, they talk about a third division called the metasympathetic. Now, Bruce probably won't test you on that, but just it would be bad if you left a neuroscience course and you've never heard about the metasympathetic system. So the metasympathetic system is more or less with your GI tract, your enteric nervous system. And so you might hear that sometimes, and you can Google it, Wikipedia it, and it's sometimes referred to as a separate nervous system. It's mostly in Eastern European. They still push it quite a bit. But there's a lot of validity to it. And you think about who really described a lot to do with the autonomic nervous system, fight or flight, or rest and digest. Any ideas, kind of the historical, where it might have come from? Any of you had general psychology class? No? Yes, maybe? Well, some of it came with actually work by Pavlov. And you probably heard of Pavlov with the bell and the dog. You know, they ring the bell to feed the dog. They just ring the bell, and then all of a sudden, the digestive juices are already flowing in the GI tract, and they've monitored that. the Russians actually have put a lot of emphasis in comparative anatomy with the autonomic nervous system. Think of a moth flying, right? It's flying around, and all of a sudden it hears a bat cry, or a bat sound, the echolation, right, for the bat. Well, that moth knows it's going to, you know, evolutionary pressures have pushed that bat, the moth, to recognize that echolation. And what does it do? In some of the moths, they'll actually fold their wings and go into a dive bomb. So it's pretty cool. So when people, behavioralists, saw that, they thought, well, how did that all relate, and how does it do it so fast? And so the Russians have been very good about looking at a comparative anatomy for the autonomic and this whole sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system in a comparative aspects with invertebrates even. You know, you go to try to step on a cockroach, and what does it do, right? It goes away from you very quickly, right? And you try to step on the other side, and it goes away the other direction. That's more or less kind of a reflex with some of the wind receptors. But then stressors that you can put on that animal and other kinds of tests, it has an ability to escape predation or respond to predation, for example. So you see the selective driving pressure in very simple organisms all the way up to more advanced organisms like ourselves. And you think about, well, what would be needing to be mobilized for a simple crustacean? They're great. But a crustacean or an insect to escape from a predator. What would you think is similar in those animals compared to you, for example? Any ideas? What do you need to do if you're trying to escape from that bear that's chasing you? What do you need to do? What do you think you need to do? Run, right? So, run. There was something else, sorry. Somebody else say something? Well, that might be one, too. He found the web page about your Beatles songs. Yes, that's to relax you. So there's some relaxing music up there on your web page as well. Well, you think about run, but what do you have to do to run? What do you need to mobilize? Skeletal muscles, right? So what do you need for your skeletal muscles to... Oxygen. And why do you need that oxygen? Just back to... It's good. It's right on. Why do we need that oxygen for your skeletal muscles? I just want to make sure we make those connections. So we can run faster, but what's that oxygen being used for? Metabolism, right. And where... The electron transport chain, right? So at the mitochondrial level to make ATP, right? And that ATP to make pump, to activate the pumps, so you can have sodium potassium exchange and calcium to go out and keep the neurons and the cells at the resting state, or for ATP for muscle contraction, the myosin heads to go back and forth and have muscle contraction. So you need that oxygen. So how do you get the oxygen there? Exactly. So increased respiration, but you also would think about maybe, for us, bronchodilate. You actually dilate your bronchi so you can breathe more, increase your heart rate so you can get your blood to your muscles, but you actually vasodilate even the capillary beds in your skeletal muscle. Wow, all that happening. Now, what happens in a simple organism? Like a wonderful crayfish, for example. If you were going to scare a crayfish, and what would it need to do? It's going to tail flip. It needs oxygenation, right? It doesn't have the same kind of circulatory system as we do, but it can actually increase its heart rate. Increase its heart rate, and it might tail flip, so the muscles need to exercise, and it's basically to get that oxygen there. They can actually, amazingly enough, it's when you hear open circulatory system, you think about the heart just dumping blood out into the whole body. But actually, in our wonderful animal like a crayfish, they actually have a circulatory system. They can direct blood flow away from the digestive tract, for example, and out towards the periphery where skeletal muscles are, or down towards the abdomen where their tail muscles are. So even though you think of open, they still can direct their blood flow accordingly. So it's pretty complex, even in a simpler animal. So it's the same idea, the same concepts, even in simple animals, all the way up to humans, if you will, about what you would have to do as an animal to try to escape that predator, all the processes that go on, right? Respiration, blood flow to skeletal muscles, for example. Any other ideas? How to get that? Where's that ATP coming from? You got oxygen, but what else is needed for that ATP to be made, for example? Glucose, exactly. And where is that glucose coming from? Good point. So wait, pardon? Diet, right? Glycogen, stores of glycogen. So how do you get that glucose from the glycogen? breaking it down, right? So you actually have enzymes that will be sped up by the sympathetic nervous system in time to actually mobilize glucose. Very fast, you can have glycogen breakdown. You can actually make, with some continual stress, gluconeogenesis, making new glucose from what? Lactate, which is your byproduct in your breaking it down, right? In glucose, you get a byproduct of lactate. You can actually take that lactate and move it into tissue that will make new glucose to keep you going, because you need the glucose to make the ATP, right? So you see, it's all pretty neat, and that's what's going to relate with this chapter, which is really exciting. So fight or flight for the sympathetic nervous system, and we just talked about what you would expect. So do you really have to memorize things? Not really. You could kind of understand what's necessary, right, if you're escaping from a predator, kind of put it all in context. But if you're relaxed now, you know, what's the other aspects with the relaxed, slower your heart rate, everything kind of back, right, in digestive functions. You don't need to be sweating and worrying about, you know, the stress. But why would you sweat if you were thinking of running from that bear? What's going to happen to your metabolism as you get excited? Body temperature goes up, right? So you start to sweat to what? Keep your body temperature back down to a homeostatic level. So you start to sweat in your palms. Like, you ever get nervous when you stand up in front of a class or somebody and you have to give a presentation? I'm kind of used to it after 18 years, so my palms don't sweat anymore. But first year, you know, standing in front of 350 freshmen biology class, I thought my shoes were just filling up with water all the time. Because you sweat, you know, and you're in your soles of your feet and your palms, and that's part of the nervousness. But it's basically to help cool you down from your increased metabolism. So that's kind of weak. So you could add that up with the sympathetic nervous system as well. And that's part of what? The lie detector test, right? Anybody know how the lie detector tests work? Anybody kind of watch those CSI movies? Anybody got an idea? How does that work when they put it on your finger? Pardon? Yeah, conductivity from the sweat, right? So they can tell if you're lying, you're going to be a little bit nervous. And so you sweat a little bit, and that's how they pick it up. Anybody ever see that movie about how to deceive the lie detector test? I know this is practical stuff versus what we have up here. Okay. Anybody ever see that? It was on a TV show, but do you remember what they did? I thought it was so cool. I just couldn't. I just was like up all night thinking, oh, that is so neat. Now I know how to get rid of that lie detector test. But they had they put a pin in, like a thumbtack, in the bottom of their shoe. And no matter what answer they were going to give, they always like stepped on it. And they knew they're going to go, like, that's going to hurt, right? So you had that kind of sympathetic response no matter what. What's your name? You know, Robin. Oh, what's your, you know, anything you did, you were always going to have that kind of same sympathetic response. So they never could really detect if you're lying or not based on that kind of assay. So remember that one. File it away, right? Never know. All right, so that's pretty neat to think about. So we think about, and this isn't in your textbook. I stole this out of our Bio 350 class. I teach animal physiology, Bio 350, on the fall semesters. But I think it's a nice explanation, because the text in your book is a little bit maybe confusing of these different systems. So when you think of the central nervous system, that's what's up in your brain, right? In your head and your spinal cord. And then you think of the peripheral nervous system, dividing it up into two groups pretty much. The sensory system, right? Sensory, and you already covered sensory, I think, right in here. So you got the sensory system, you know, sending it up into your CNS. And then you had the motor system. And the motor system is divided up into two major groups. Remember these terms too, afferent and efferent. Afferent's what's going to the CNS, and efferent's what's coming out of the CNS. So, you know, to and back. And those are kind of standardized test kind of questions that they ask you in MCATs and PSATs and all those kind of good exams. But the motor system's generally divided up into two groups, like we said, somatic and autonomic. And this is what we're focusing on today. Somatic is what's the precursor to your skeletal muscles and the somites. And we'll show you a picture here in a little bit about that. And that is where you have motor neurons that control your skeletal muscles. The autonomic nervous system is divided up in what we just had mentioned, sympathetic and parasympathetic. You could list a third one there, but just in your own mind, the metasympathetic system as well. It's kind of what's inside of your enteric nervous system. Okay, so we think about the somatic nervous system and the autonomic nervous system. And what's kind of different with the autonomic nervous system? You can have various actions. Remember, your skeletal muscles are basically your somites. That's to contract your skeletal muscles, right? But the autonomic nervous system can do so many different things. Various actions. In some skeletal muscles, in the circulatory bed, it'll actually promote vasodilation. But in another circulatory bed, like in your GI tract, it's going to cause vasoconstriction. And so, well, two opposite kind of responses to the circulatory system, but it depends on the tissue bed you're thinking of. I tend to give this corny example in animal physiology, so sorry that you ones that have already heard it before, but how to kind of relate with the autonomic nervous system and I think put a lot of these concepts together. You're in the woods, it's nighttime, right? You're walking and you're trying to get up to your cabin. And, you know, Friday night, tests are over, you're going to go party. And you're trying to find your cabin that you've kind of forgot where it was. And you're walking, it's dark. And all of a sudden, you hear a stick crack behind you. You know, what's going to happen to you, right? Your heart rate's going to shoot up. You're going to be all nervous, right? And you're just like, oh my God, what is this thing behind me? And then you hear a bear that's kind of like growling around, right? So you're pretty nervous about it. And so your heart rate goes up, blood flow to your skeletal muscles, you're starting to sweat. You may or might not, if somebody was watching you, you may give a response that somebody could detect, but otherwise you might just be walking really still and like, hey, what is that noise, right? But you're very sensitive to everything. Probably what? If you wanted to be able to see that, what's going to happen to your pupil? Probably dilate, right? So you can see really well. Depends if light, if it's bright or not. All right? So you can think of all those kind of things. And then you realize, what did you have in your backpack? Oh, I forgot I brought my gun with me. And, you know, so boom, you shot this bear and you dragged it up to your cabin and you thought, okay, so now I can have some bear steaks. I'm just making this scenario. And you got up to your cabin, which has electricity and everything. And so you cut up your bear and you're firing the steak on the grill. And now your parasympathetic nervous system's working, right? And so what are you getting ready to? Now you've realized that you've turned on your hot tub. You have electricity up there. This is a really nice cabin. And you're got your bear steaks. You're ready for digestion. You open up a bottle of wine if you're over 21. And you're starting to have your wine. And your significant other is with you in the hot tub. And you're beginning to think about other things, right? And so what's going on now? So you're not getting blood flow to your skeletal muscles, but to some other muscles. And then you're actually getting digestive processes working, right? So you can think of the parasympathetic nervous system. Heart rate's slow, and that's what's happening with your parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so you can see the variation depending on the tissue bed you're talking about. All right, so hopefully that helps you to put some of this in context. All right, so the somatic nervous system, it's fast, right, for skeletal muscle contraction to give a response. And you think about how fast you can contract your skeletal muscles. It's pretty quick, right? If you're walking and you trip, you stumble, right, how fast that process really goes to keep you from stumbling and you can catch yourself. So that's pretty quick, and it's, you know, direct commands to your skeletal muscles, right? And without that integration from the motor nerve to the muscle, there's nothing in between. It's just direct from the motor neuron to the skeletal muscle. Where the sympathetic and autonomic nervous system, we're going to see that there's a relay process involved with that. All right, so here we go. Fight or flight. You can think about what's happening to that poor little dog, right? Scared to death. And the other one's in a totally aggressive response. So actually, there's in some textbooks they use the... It's somewhat vulgar in a way, but, you know, okay. We're in college. For the four Fs for the autonomic nervous system. Fear, fight or flight, and reproduction. All right, so you can think of it. All right, that's part of it. It took me a while when I read that the first time. What? Okay, but anyways, we got it. So this is more like a fear response right away. It's not, you know, what can happen. You can imagine this kind of activity that's going on with this poor dog. All right, so these tables I pulled out of an animal physiology textbook, and it will help you to, I don't want you to try to memorize these things, and Bruce will see these PowerPoints as well, how I modified them, but I think it helps you to understand some of these points and put it into a textual concept for you. But all of this you've already know because we just went through it. So if you pick any one of these particular aspects, like what we were talking about, heart, for example, sympathetic increases the heart rate. But there's some subtleties we might not know about quite yet. Not only does it increase the heart rate, but it increases the force of contraction. So you eject more blood out. So it's what's referred to as chronotropic and inotropic. And chronotropic is time, so it increases heart rate, but it also increases the strength of the heart rate. So that's pretty neat to think about. There's more to it than just increasing heart rate. Some other aspects that are interesting, and we'll talk a little bit more about it. I don't know if you're that familiar with different tissues in your body, but the adrenal medulla, which sits right above your kidneys, it's interesting. The adrenal medulla, there's a cortex, which is the outside, and then there's the medulla, which is on the inside. It actually comes from neural tissue in development. From embryologically development, it's neural tissue that migrates to that region and forms the adrenal medulla. So it's actually neural tissue. And it releases what we have heard in your other classes or other lectures before, transmitters, norepinephrine and epinephrine. But it releases it into your bloodstream. And it releases it into your bloodstream so it can have an effect like increasing your heart rate systemically into your blood. And the adrenal medulla is quite active during your sympathetic drive, and it has really no effect during the parasympathetic. And we'll talk a little bit about this as we go along a bit more. And it's quite interesting to relate all the what these actions can be in the body. All right, and as we mentioned, the lungs, what do you want to do if you're scared? Increase your ability to get oxygen, so you bronchodilate. So you dilate your bronchi so you can get more air into your body and for making that ATP in your mitochondria. So isn't that kind of cool? But you've got to get that oxygen to the mitochondria, so increase circulation and heart rate. And then some other aspects, you know, we're really not trying to digest, so we don't need to worry about gallbladder contractions and contractility in the smooth muscle, for example. But here's the point about raising glucose. Increase glycogenolysis, breaking down glycogen so you can have more blood glucose circulating, right? So that glucose can be used for your cell metabolism to make ATP. And then here's the arterioles, your blood supply to your capillary beds. In some muscles, you vasoconstrict, and in other muscles, you may vasodilate. Dilate to your skeletal muscles, constrict to your GI bed, all right? Because you're not thinking about eating it, right? At this point when you're scared. So your text has this wonderful figure up here with all these different tissues, and you can kind of think about what they're different doing, sympathetic and parasympathetic. And what's interesting to kind of relate is the sympathetic comes from this middle region in your spinal cord. It's the thoracic lumbar region in the middle of your spinal cord. The parasympathetic comes from your cranial sacral region, so cranial sacral. And we're going to make some analogies here in a little bit so you can help remember this and recall it. But just to kind of hit it right now, parasympathetic, a pair, cranial sacral, pair, okay? And the sympathetic is just your thoracic lumbar region here. And then you can think of the different tissues and what the functions are on those tissues from those tables, for example. All right. And then your textbook has this other wonderful figure to kind of show the cross section or this section of the body with the spinal cord and these system that's going out to the different tissues. And we'll talk about these relay stations here in just a little bit. This is the sympathetic chain ganglion because it's a chain and they're ganglion in here. These are where the neurons synapse, make a connection, and then a second order neuron will then go out to the target tissue. So that's kind of neat to see. And we'll go through that in a little bit. Now, Bruce had this, Dr. O'Hara had this in the text, and I have a feeling he wants you to memorize his cranial nerves, but you can clarify it with him to make sure. But he did have this mnemonic that's in your text. I think there might be one in your textbook. Is there one in your textbook? Probably didn't have this one because that's kind of vulgar, but anyways. This is from Bruce. And ways to kind of memorize these 12 cranial nerves. And they're named from the anterior part to the posterior part, or the rostral to caudal part of the brain. So the first ones are way up here, 1, and then all the way to 12 down here. And so the cranial nerves, some of those have functions within the autonomic nervous system. So that's probably why this is put in at this particular point. So we'll talk a little bit about that. So I don't know at what extent he wants you to memorize these different cranial nerves. We'll have to clarify with Dr. O'Hara. But you should know there's 12 cranial nerves. If you're in allied health, you're going to have to memorize those sooner or later. Those have appeared on standardized exams. Anybody that's taken the MCAT yet? And, you know, okay, and they probably had some of these, or even on the PSAT test, they might have those for pharmacy school, for example. And so I would know them if you're planning on any kind of standardized health exam for entry. Olfactory, that makes sense, right? Olfaction, optic for the vision. Ocular motor, we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, but this is controlling the eye. And the fourth, trochocular. The five, trigeminal. Six, abducens. Seven, facial. Eight, auditory vestibular for hearing and your vestibular function. Nine, glossopharyngeal. Glossal, pharyngeal, your pharynx region. Tenth, the vagus. The vagal nerve is very important. It controls your heart. It releases acetylcholine and slows your heart down, right? Cranial sacral. These are cranial nerves. What do we know about cranial sacral nerves? Parasympathetic, right? Parasympathetic, relaxed state. So you excite the vagal nerve, your heart rate starts to slow down. Pretty cool. It releases acetylcholine. Your skeletal muscles also, the somatic motor nerves, they're acetylcholine too. They release acetylcholine onto your skeletal muscles and you have contraction. But on your heart, it causes slowing down of your heart rate. Okay, so it's kind of neat to think about these differences that go on with the same neurotransmitter. Because why? It's really the receptors that give the function, what type of receptors you have and how they respond to that transmitter. It's not so much the transmitter, it's the receptor, right? And how that then is going to respond for that target tissue. Okay, so the vagal nerve is very important. Just as a curiosity, I go off on tangents. If you took the nervous system to the heart and you cut the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, what's your normal heart rate anyways? Anybody? About? I know we're going to count it now. One, two, three, no. Okay. About 70 beats per minute, unless it's an exam day. And then it, you know, probably skyrocketed. But if you cut the nervous system to your heart, your heart rate will go up. That's kind of interesting. And that tells you that you generally have parasympathetic innervation that's keeping your heart rate down. All right, so there's this continual suppression of your heart rate by the vagal nerve. All right, then the 11th spinal accessory and the 12th hypoglossal. And so this was in your on the PowerPoints and how to remember some of these, generally the names. You can think of this mnemic process. But I actually have this website up here. Let me see. And it's on your in your PowerPoints. I'm just going to put that one over there on that board over there so you can see it. So I made a link to a Wikipedia site that you can actually pull that up, or at some site that I found on the web yesterday that might help you with knowing some of these processes. And I want to go over those in just a second. Here it comes. So you can see some of those processes over there, and the things to kind of remember is what are they working with. Like the facial, you see that there's parasympathetic involved there. You see ocular motor, parasympathetic to your ciliary muscles and papillary constrictor muscles to allow dilation of your pupil, right, or constriction depending on what they need. But remember, cranial sacral, cranial parasympathetic, right? So it's easy. But if you wanted to know which ones have innervation to them with the parasympathetic, then you can go through there and use vagal nerve, we just talked about that, right, to the abdomen, thorax, neck, heart, and I think those are the main cranial nerves with the parasympathetic innervation to them. Alright, enteric nervous system, mostly to function for digestion of food, right, and releasing of substances that help you with digestion of food. Think about the enzymes that are being released to help you break down your food and what's going on there. You need blood supply to your GI tract to help get the food that you're going to absorb into your body, but also to get hormones to the tissue so it can function. All right. So basically, esophagus, stomach, intestines, pancreas, and gallbladder. The pancreas and gallbladder release substances that help with digestive processes. So you can think of the parasympathetic helping to activate those so you can have good digestion. All right. And then think of the central control of this. This is what we just went through a little bit of the systems. Parasympathetic, cranial, sacral, like we had up there. And then the autonomic nervous system is kind of neat. It's this paraventricular zone, connects the brainstem, spinal cord, nuclei. And I don't know, did you already have some central anatomy where these regions are in the brain? No, kind of? All right. If not, like the nucleus of the solitary tract, that's part of for respiration and control of breathing. That's in your brainstem. Think of your brainstem as the same aspect in your brainstem as it is in a lizard, a snake, or any other kind of vertebrate animal, because it's the same functions. It controls your heart rate. It controls your breathing. It monitors CO2 and pH. You need to regulate that just as well as a salamander or a snake or a bird does. So that same kind of arrangement is inside your brainstem as is in other vertebrates as well. And you can think about what you need to regulate there, how fast your heart's beating or respiratory function. All right. Your text goes through some of, or in Bruce's PowerPoints, goes through some of the neurotransmitters and the different aspects in the pharmacology here. I think there's a little easier way I'm going to go through this, but this text is up there and you can look at it in your PowerPoints and kind of get an idea of what's going on. But think about the actions of these transmitters to the receptors. It's the receptors that make the difference, and I'll emphasize that in a minute. So when we talk about preganglionic and postganglionic cells, I just want to become familiar with what that means. I'm going to go back on the slide. Remember here, preganglionic means from the spinal cord to the ganglion. Postganglionic means from that ganglion to the target tissue. If it's the cranial sacral, think of this as preganglionic and this is postganglionic. So they're referring to the ganglion out here in the periphery. So pre is from the parasympathetic, from the cranial nerves to that ganglion, and then that ganglion to the target tissue. That's postganglionic and preganglionic before that. So those are the terminology to kind of get down and with this functions. And then what kind of transmitters are released in the preganglionic and postganglionic. So we'll go through that, and I think it'll be a little bit easier to see this next slide, but that these are up here to kind of, in case you want to think about some of these actions, acetylcholine's inhibitory or inhibitory actions of for acetylcholine on muscarinic actions. So what do we mean by these muscarinic action of acetylcholine versus like your skeletal muscles is nicotinic? So I think this might help a little bit. This kind of figure has the parasympathetic and the sympathetic drawings here. So you think of preganglionic. Let's think about the parasympathetic. What's the preganglionic? The cranial nerve, right? And then it's going to that ganglion, and then the postganglionic is from that ganglion to the target tissue. All right, so this is preganglionic, parasympathetic, cranial or sacral nerve. And then it's releasing acetylcholine. And what's interesting is the postganglionic cell also releases acetylcholine onto the target tissue. But remember, it's the receptor subtypes that make the difference. The sympathetic, the preganglionic, thoracic lumbar, goes to the ganglion, and it also releases acetylcholine. Okay? So they both release acetylcholine. But the postganglionic and the sympathetic releases norepinephrine. And that's the difference here between these. So here we have norepinephrine. What else is different in this figure that you see? And it's not really mentioned in your textbook that much, but it's shown in those figures. You see the differences in the lengths of these in general? In the parasympathetic, it's a longer preganglionic. In the sympathetic, it's usually a short neuron, a short length of axon to that ganglion cell because it's coming from the thoracic lumbar going a short distance compared to a cranial sacral nerve, which has to go a longer distance. And then it's a longer postganglionic in the sympathetic where it's actually a short in the parasympathetic. What's something else to help remember this? Remember cranial sacral, parasympathetic. Here's another pair, acetylcholine, acetylcholine. So now you have the parasympathetic down, cranial sacral, but also acetylcholine, acetylcholine. All right. So it might help you to remember these differences. The other part that's a little bit hard to maybe put together is these types of receptors. So here's another diagram from an animal physiology textbook, and I think it helps, but it was also in your text that Dr. O'Hara provided. So parasympathetic and sympathetic, they both release acetylcholine. The first receptor subtype on the ganglion are both nicotinic. What do we mean by these names? You don't release nicotine in your naturally, right? This is a pharmacological definition, right? Nicotinic and muscarinic. It's just pharmacological agents to try to separate out receptor subtypes. And generally, we talk about acetylcholine as a nicotinic and muscarinic. So here is nicotinic. Nicotine will activate these, all right? And you think of the parasympathetic, acetylcholine again, right? Pair onto the heart, for example, muscarinic acetylcholine receptors. Muscarin would activate those. So they're muscarinic receptors. And the sympathetic, what's different about that is the norepinephrine, there are different types of receptors at the target tissue for norepinephrine. Some of those will cause vasodilation. Some of those could help in vasoconstriction. Depends on the target tissue that you're referring to. This really confused people in the literature for a long time because they would give norepinephrine on one tissue to see constriction. Give it to another tissue and it dilated. But it's the same transmitter. How come it's not doing the same thing? It's because of the receptors. The tissue had different types of receptors on it, and that helped them to understand then the differences of these things. So I actually made a little link on your point. Oh, let's go to this site instead. And you can then look at that and see what's there. I'll just open the hyperlink real quick here. If it does open. Adrenergic receptors, and what might help you if you're confused a little bit about that is it separates out the type of receptors here. So you can see alpha 1, alpha 2, beta receptors. Noradrenaline or norepinephrine, remember adrenaline and epinephrine is the same thing. Noradrenaline and norepinephrine is the same thing. All right, just don't get confused on the names. But these receptors, depending on the tissue, they might have different densities of these receptors or the different receptor subtypes, and they give different responses. So it's not the transmitter, it's the receptors that you have to watch out for. All right? Let's go to another good example to try to explain. Bruce wanted to watch this for class, so we can do that. And I think it'll be fun. Now, why is that not happening? I guess I have to go to this one, maybe. Why zebras don't get ulcers.
If you're a normal mammal, what stresses about is 3 minutes of screaming terror on the savanna, after which it's under over with you or over with. For a few seconds.
Whoops.
Every year or so, Sapolsky shifts his lab to a place more than 9,000 miles away on the plains of the Masai Mara Reserve in Kenya, East Africa. You live in a place like this, you're a baboon, and you only have to spend about 3 hours a day getting your calories. If you only have to work 3 hours a day, you've got 9 hours of free time every day to devote to making somebody else just miserable. They're not being stressed by lions chasing them all the time. They're being stressed by each other. They're being stressed by social and psychological tools invented by their own species. They're a perfect model for westernized stress-related disease. Because what stress is about is somebody is very intent on eating you, or you are very intent on eating somebody, and there's an immediate crisis going on. When you run for your life, basics are all that matter. Lungs work overtime to pump mammoth quantities of oxygen into the bloodstream. The heart races to pump that oxygen throughout the body, so muscles respond instantly. You need your blood pressure up to deliver that energy. You need to turn off anything that's not essential. Growth, reproduction, you know, you run into your life. This is no time to ovulate. Tissue repair, all that sort of thing. Do it later if there is a later.
When the zebra escapes, its stress response shuts down. But human beings can't seem to find their off switch.
We turn on the exact same stress response for purely psychological states, thinking about the ozone layer, the taxes coming up, mortality, 30-year mortgages. We turn on the same stress response, and the key difference there is we're not doing it for a real physiological reason, and we're doing it nonstop. After a while, the stress response is more damaging than the stressor itself, because the stressor is some psychological nonsense that you're falling for. No zebra on earth running for its life would understand why fear of speaking in public would cause you to secrete the same hormones that it's doing at that point to save its life.
So hopefully you get some ideas. This is a faculty member at Stanford University, and he's written a book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. You know, they have stress for a short period of time. They're running from their lion, right? And the rest of the time they can be grazing and functioning fine, reproducing like he was mentioning. But then if you have that constant stress, you know, what does that do to the body, for example? Like having an exam every day, a quiz every day, you know, right? That would just stress you out. So that's bad. There's another video on YouTube that Dr. O'Hara had on his PowerPoint, but it's about 30 minutes long, so I'm not going to show that in class, but you might want to watch it. It's really neat. I saw it last night, and it's fascinating. He's a wonderful lecturer, and he's giving a main lecture for Stanford graduates in this presentation, but he goes through a lot of his life work in that YouTube video, so you might want to watch that. Basically, the take-home from Robert's presentation is, you know, put it all in perspective. You make your own stressors, basically, in humans, right? If you're not trying to escape from a predator, right? Is it going to be stressful? You do just study and do the best you can, and don't stress over it because it's not going to be worth it. You're probably damaging yourself about it. The idea about grooming someone is the idea in that other video where the monkeys or the chimps groom each other, and it actually calms them down, it relaxes them. So I guess you can comb your significant other's hair or something like that if they have hair, whatever. And don't get gored by, you know, some other lion attacking. So let's go back to that constant fight or flight response and think about this other aspect. I bring this up in our physiology class. And because this has appeared on a standardized exam before, an MCAT, so I'm bringing it up now. It's not in your textbook, but there's actually a syndrome called GAS. And it's not gas, making gas in your stomach, but it's the general adaptation syndrome. And it's when you could have constant stress. Or you put an animal in a cage and it's very stressed out, walking in circles, trying to escape. And so you think about what's going on with your sympathetic nervous system just as an acute response. But then keep that going constantly. What's happening, right? You're just, your heart rate's going all the time, and you're going to get fatigued, right? You're going to get tired. So there's different phases with this. So the alarm and mobilization is kind of like what we talked about with the sympathetic nervous system. Heart rate goes up, blood flow, you know, to the right organs and stuff, and you become aware of that bear behind you, right? Resistance stage. Oh, I'm not so stressed out anymore. Maybe I can take that bear, you know, or not. You found out you got your gun. You know, you can do something to it. And so you're not that immediately stressed out. You're beginning to think now. You can start to think about how to get out of that stressful condition. But if it continually stressed you out, think of that bear continually chasing you, right? Or you have an exam every day, or, you know, somebody's bugging you every day, then that can actually have a very detrimental effect to you. Think about what we just said about raising your glucose levels. How are you going to raise your glucose levels if you don't have time to eat? Right? You're on the run all the time. How are you going to raise your glucose levels? You're going to release a hormone, right, that helps you to do that. Anybody know what kind of hormone that could be? Cortisol. And that's from your adrenal cortex. Remember we talked about the adrenal medulla for norepinephrine and epinephrine? The cortex releases hormones like cortisol. And that's a stress hormone. It's very stressful. You probably released it in the morning just getting out of bed to get your foot, you know, one side of the bed out, and then a little more, you know, stress to get the other foot out. But you raised your cortisol levels probably around 5 o'clock this morning to get what? Your glucose levels up. And so that raises your glucose. But what if you didn't have that glycogen store and you're continually stressed? Where's that glucose going to come from? You're going to start to break down the fat. That might be good for me probably. But then, but also you're going to start to break down protein. So you start to break down what protein is really abundant in your body. Skeletal muscle. So you're going to start to get muscle wasting, atrophy. You're going to start to break down your muscles. So chronic stress is not good. It's actually detrimental to you, right? And then you think about all that metabolism that's going on all the time. So this is what's referred to as that exhaustion stage. And you can think of some disease states like Cushing's syndrome. It kind of pushes us to the extreme. Cushing's syndrome is where you have too much cortisol released. Maybe a tumor in your adrenal cortex. It's releasing cortisol all the time. What's happening with cortisol? And I know this is kind of small, but there's another mimic to it. But you can look it up online. Look up Cushing's syndrome. And it's like releasing cortisol all the time. Think of that related with that exhaustion stage and gas. Cushingoid is with Cushing's syndrome. Well, what's happening here? Cataracts, ulcers, right? Because probably acid being released all the time in your stomach, just, you know, getting too stressed out. Skin problems, you can actually get striations of your skin, different coloration of your skin, like stretch marks in a wheel. If you will, you get brown marks on your abdomen. And it's because of the adrenal cortex releasing other hormones as well. You bruise easy. You actually can decrease your immune function. Initially, it can actually enhance it, but with long-term stress, you actually decrease your immune response. Necrosis and osteoporosis, cortisol, some people get cortisol injections all the time to help them out, maybe with inflammation, but they found out it actually can cause your bone to degrade. And some people that have had lots of cortisol over their time, some of their bones have actually degraded, and it causes osteoporosis from having to help with, say, an inflammation. Too much cortisol is bad. All right. And diabetes. Why diabetes? Raising that glucose level all the time, right? And you have high glucose. So there's those issues around that. So that's kind of where we left, the end of this. Hopefully you got some ideas of these different systems and what they do. And if you have any questions, glad to answer any emails. Echo and PowerPoint is up online, and the podcast will be there too on that webpage. All right.